Hi, friends, and welcome to Reading Jewish History in the Parsha, where each week we share an idea in the Parsha and how it relates to Jewish history, along with all the books and articles I've read over Shabbos to learn more about it. Just a reminder to sign up for our weekly email, readingjewishhistoryintheparsha.substack.com, where you'll get a write-up of our weekly class, along with all the links to the articles and books that I have discovered on my Shabbos reading journeys. Thank you so much to our friends and sponsors, Jana and Lior Hoden family, with immense gratitude to Hashem. Some jokes become so common and cliche that they serve more as social commentary than as a recipe for laughter. And particularly with Jewish jokes, especially the ones you've heard before, it's less about the laughter the joke provokes, because it's not much, and more about what the joke says about those who tell it and understand it. So with that very unfunny introduction, here is a not-so-funny joke you've most likely heard before. A Jewish man who has been stranded on an island alone for 20 years, finally he is rescued. The Jewish man insists on showing the rescuers the life that he has built for himself on the island. They come across a small clearing with a bunch of makeshift buildings. He points to the closest one. "That's my home." He continues to point to the other buildings as they walk by. "There's the supermarket and the bank, and they're kind of made from trees and all this stuff. The saloon, and over there is my synagogue where I went to pray that someone would come and rescue me." A rescuer pointed to a lone building away from the rest. "And what's that one?" The Jewish man disdainfully says, "Oh, that's the other shul. We don't go there." As I said, you probably heard it before, but it is interesting that Jews are so synonymous with break-off shul, side minyanim, considering there seems to be an explicit prohibition exactly for that type of behavior. In our Parsha, Parshas Re'eh, we find the following at the beginning of the 14th chapter. "Banim atem laHashem Elokeichem, lo sisgodedu v'lo tasimu karcha bein einechem lameis." You are children of God, of Hashem. You shall not gash yourselves or shave the front of your heads because of the dead. The Talmud in Tractate Yevamos interprets lo sisgodedu, which plainly means not making a gash during this time of mourning, as also including a prohibition against breaking off from the central community. As an aside, can't believe I'm mentioning this, but here we are, I never understood the practice of cutting oneself while in mourning, like what's this even about, until watching, you guessed it, Kevin Costner in the titular role Robin Hood Prince of Thieves, where he cuts his hand after the murder of his father. Do I have a picture of that scene in our weekly email, Reading Jewish History in the Parsha.substack.com? You better believe it. Why does the Talmud find an illusion for not separating from the mainstream community from a verse that plainly seems to be talking about not cutting yourself while in mourning? These two actions seemingly have nothing to do with each other. In order to understand this, let's explore the history of the schism of Hungarian Jewry and the emergence of the Orthodox community. The Hungarian Jewish community in the mid-19th century did not take to reforms in Jewish life kindly. The legacy of Rav Moshe Sofer, known as the Chassam Sofer, still hovered in the collective memory of communal leaders well beyond his passing in 1939. His classic pun, Chadash Asar Min HaTorah, which originally is a statement that the Talmud makes, a principle about eating grains from the new harvest, known as Chadash, was applied instead to oppose all innovations in Jewish life and practice. During his lifetime, the Chassam Sofer battled against figures like Rabbi Aaron Chorin, whose ritual innovations were seen by the Chassam Sofer and his students as uprooting traditional life and practice. Of course, the Chassam Sofer himself was extraordinarily creative and innovative in his approach. That's why I always point this out. The Chassam Sofer was all about chiddush, innovation, but still took a very firm conservative approach to those whose innovations were seen as threatening to the very foundation of traditional Jewish life. Following the death of the Chassam Sofer, the traditional Jewish community had opposing factions on how to approach those advocating for more radical reforms in Jewish practice and Jewish life. Rav Israel Hildesheimer advocated for a more conciliatory approach, favoring the idea of rabbis who are proficient in both traditional Torah learning, as well as some of the more modern academic methods. He was vehemently opposed by many students of the Chassam Sofer or his students, including Rev Akiva Yosef Schlesinger, who studied under the son of the Chassam Sofer, the Ksav Sofer, as well as the Chassam Sofer's prize student, the Maharam Shik. Meanwhile, reformers opposed to both more traditional schools, such as Rabbi Leopold Lowe. He looked awesome, I'll just be honest with you. I know he wasn't a traditional Orthodox rabbi, but wow, Did he have a cool look? Championed a school of reform that was somewhat grounded in tradition, at least in contrast to more radical reformers in Germany and the United States. But he used these more academic approaches to advocate for a more flexible and progressive interpretation of Jewish law. Eventually, these warring factions within the traditional community led to the official schism of Hungarian Jewry in the 19th century. The Orthodox community sought to strictly adhere to traditional Jewish law and practice, rejecting any modern influences. In contrast, the Neolog community embraced moderate reforms, such as adopting some aspects of modern culture and adjusting religious practices to fit contemporary life while still maintaining Jewish identity. I think one of the big issues was riding on a railroad on Shabbos, as many other things, but there were things that they were opposed to. They did not want to move Shabbos to Sunday. The real radical reforms they were opposed to. The status quo community emerged as a middle ground, not aligning fully with either the Orthodox or Neolog movements, and preferred a more flexible approach to religious observance. This division, and this story is so fascinating, though I'm not really going into depth, was formalized after a government-mandated Congress in 1868-1869 that created the lasting tensions and separate institutional structures within Hungarian Jewry. For a while, these divisions were a feature of Hungarian Jewry with little parallel on American soil, where nearly all Jews agreed in America, in some measure, to interacting with modernity and American culture. That all changed, however, in 1928 from a curious exchange in a little-known Torah journal called Apirion, as discussed by Professor Adam Furziger in his fantastic book Beyond Sectarianism, The Realignment of American Orthodox Judaism. That book, the first chapter, which this is really based on, at least this part is based on an earlier article that he wrote called Hungarian Separatist Orthodoxy and the Migration of Its Legacy to America, the Greenwald Hershenson Debate, an article that was published in the Jewish Quarterly Review. Of course, as always, we have links to both in our weekly Substack. A letter was published in this journal, Apirion, that was written by someone named Rav Yekusiel Yehuda Greenwald. He's probably most famous for writing the Kolbo on Avelos that compiled all of the laws and customs, changed some of them, but most of the laws on Avelos really come back to his work on Avelos, on mourning. And he wrote this open letter, this Rav Yekusiel Yehuda Greenwald wrote an open letter to someone named Rav Chaim Hershenson. I have a copy of the exact letter in our weekly email, reading Jewish History in the Parsha.substack.com. It begins with these words, Michtav Galoy, like an open letter. He writes to Rav Hershenson. It's a bit of a strange letter. It begins with an explanation as to how the editors of the journal in a previous issue knew to offer special birthday wishes to Rav Hershenson, who recently had celebrated his 70th birthday. Rav Greenwald explained in his letter that it was he, in fact, who supplied Rav Hershenson's birthday, allowing for the glowing 70th birthday wishes. Then the letter takes a turn. Rav Greenwald then explains, so I knew it was your birthday. I'm the one who told the editors, but I did not contribute to your birthday celebration. Why did I not contribute to your birthday celebration? He's got quite an answer. He has major issues with Rav Hershenson. This is what he writes. This translation is from Professor Furziger. I did not participate in this work. Why? In your Talmudic novella, your writings on the Talmud, you wrote, who he's quoting Rav Hershenson now, and terrible trouble was brought by the Hungarian sages upon Israel. And he goes on to criticize the Hungarian separatist approach. And in the fourth volume of your work, Malki Bakodesh, you recorded that ever since our brothers, the sons of Hungary, settled in the land of Israel, infighting and division have grown. Sectarian dissension and multiplication of irreparable splits has long been the national sickness of the children of Hungary. Forgive me, writes Rev Greenwald, honorable one, for your pen has spilled an inadvertent sin. You that labors to find goodness among the light-hearted evildoers who publicly desecrate the Shabbos while regarding the brilliant rabbis of Israel that saved the country from total destruction, you find no redeeming qualities, meaning you spend all this time with American Jews and you're criticizing Hungarian Jews who are championing authentic Judaism. From these words, I could only conclude that you possess hatred toward our our brothers, the children of Israel, from my birthplace. That stems from ignorance as to the reason for the division and the fissures. When I recognized this, I made an about face, for I thought, am I not one of them, a person from the same country that brought terrible misery upon Israel? Because he himself also is from Hungary. At the heart of their debate was the merits of the Hungarian Jewish communal model. Interestingly, neither rabbi, not Rav Greenwald, not Rav Herzenstein, could be characterized by the more hardline conservative approach to orthodoxy of actual Hungarian Jews. Both of them were somewhat moderate in their respective approaches to American Jewry. Rav Herzenstein, who was more than three decades older than Rav Greenwald, served as a Rav in Hoboken, New Jersey. I've been there, where he was an early proponent of religious Zionism and engaged with many of the secular trends of modernity sweeping the nation: egalitarianism, democracy, technology, and scientific discovery. He was a very innovative and forward thinker. Rav Greenwald was not exactly the paradigm of classic Hungarian traditionalism himself, despite his strong defense of their approach. As a rabbi in Columbus, Ohio's Beth Jacob, a shul that I think I've been to and it's still there, he invited Golda Meir to speak and even allowed separate seating without a mechitza. On some matters, however, his uncompromising Hungarian approach from his upbringing, where he was raised in Hungary, was evident. He was extraordinarily strict on the laws of Shabbos, admonishing kosher butchers who opened their stores too soon after Shabbos. He excommunicated and burnt the siddur of the Reconstructionist founder, Rabbi Mordechai Kaplan, a fascinating story in his own right for a different week. Once after learning a congregant had driven to shul, he canceled an entire series of Friday night lectures. That was all the buzz and the rage back then, to have a Friday night lecture to accommodate and encourage people to come to synagogue on Friday nights. Despite his own openness relative to the actual Hungarian model, Rev Greenwald still yearned for a more authentic expression of Jewish life in America. He was extraordinarily suspicious of the emerging modern Orthodox approach in America, which seemed to him to compromise far too much for modern sensibilities. In the introduction to Rev Greenwald's work, Achlat Sara, he minces no words in his disdain for modern Orthodoxy. I'm going to translate it, and the translation's from Professor Furziger, but the original, of course, I have in the email. The original's even kind of more humorous to read. He's got a funny, comical way of writing. You really do want to check out this email. I'm not going to read the whole thing in Hebrew, but it's more fun reading in the Hebrew. This is what he writes in Achlat Sara. I myself have heard a speaker who was known by the title Rabbi that, when eulogizing before the deceased, spoke of the greatness of the Russian author Tolstoy. That was hard to read in Hebrew. Once upon a time, the children of Israel knew well that those who act in this way were called free thinkers, or the deviants of Israel, reformers who have no place among the kosher Israelites. Today, I'm going to read in Hebrew, Avol b'yameinu today, elu yadabru b'shem orthodoxia modernia, the modern orthodox. Today, they speak in the name of modern orthodoxy, and the rabbi is modern orthodox, which means that he has the right to change, limit, or add as the times demand, as long as he is called orthodox. He elaborates somewhat comically in a footnote about the ills of modern orthodoxy. This is a great line. He says, orthodoxy modernit maka asher lo kesuva batorahi, modern orthodoxy, a plague that does not appear in the Torah, in the Bible. They destroy all that is holy. On Shabbos evening, they gather in the synagogue, arriving in automobiles. They park on all the surrounding streets. The entire congregation sings tunes, women and men together, young ladies and women chant in front of the Holy Ark, and the modern Orthodox rabbi babbles about Spinoza. I don't know what modern Orthodox shul he was going to. I actually do. There's speculation in Professor Furziger's article who he's talking about, the shul on the other side of Columbus, Spinoza, Schopenhauer, and other such friends. This is their Shabbos evening worship of God, and they throw their spears on all who try to speak out against them. They eat their meals anywhere, and even in the homes of women who desecrate the Shabbos in public. They also belittle the adultery laws, and without proper investigation and testimony, they declare a woman to be eligible for marriage. While this is not the first time the term modern Orthodox appears, it was used here likely for the first time as a derisive label, distinct from the more authentic orthodoxy Rev Greenwald remembered from his youth in Hungary. As Professor Furziger explains, in applying this latter tag to his adversaries, Greenwald established that they were different from both the Reform and Conservative, but he simultaneously distinguished them, meaning the modern Orthodox, from true or authentic Orthodox Jewry. This served him well, for it provided a clear branding for those who deviated from his traditionalist European style Orthodoxy. No longer longer did he need to complain about these figures and congregations usurping the name Orthodox. Rather, by highlighting the formal category of modern Orthodox, he could spare the genuine Orthodox being classified in one broad rubric with less committed Jews. No training could have schooled him better for intuiting this boundary definition tool than his own upbringing at the heart of Hungarian Orthodoxy. Questions of separatism continued to haunt the Orthodox Jewish community long after the passing of both Rav Hirschenson, who died in 1935, and Rav Greenwald, who died in 1955. In fact, a year later, in June 1956, a psak din, a halachic ruling, was published in Hapardes, a popular rabbinic journal, by the leading American Rosh Yeshiva at the time, forbidding participation in the Synagogue Council of America, an umbrella organization that included both Orthodox and non-Orthodox rabbis for social welfare and social services. Noticeably absent from the Rosh Yeshiva who signed was Rev Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, a Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshiva University and the acknowledged leader of, you guessed it, the modern Orthodox community. Those who signed were incredible. They were the leading Rosh Yeshiva of America, Rev Avram Yafrin, Rev Avram Kalmanovitz, Aaron Cutler, Rev Gedalia Shor, Rev David Lifshitz, who was also a fellow Rosh Yeshiva in Yeshiva University, Rev Chaim Mordechai Katz, I know less about him, Rev Yaakov Kamenetsky, Rav Yaakov Yitzchak Halevi Ruderman, he was in Yeshivas Neri Yisrael in Baltimore, Rav Yitzchak Kuttner, that's in Chaim Berlin, Rav Menachem Yosef Zaks, I believe that is the son-in-law of the Chafetz Chaim, I could be wrong, and Rav Moshe Feinstein. As detailed by Jonathan J. Golden in his dissertation From Cooperation to Confrontation, The Rise and Fall of the Synagogue Council of America, there was a significant amount of behind-the-scenes politics that marginalized Rabbi Soloveitchik, despite his deep relationships with his fellow Rosh Yeshiva. Still, what was done, and their differing approaches to the contours of Orthodox cooperation with the non-Orthodox world opened up deeper fissures within the Orthodox world that are still felt today. How insular and detached from the rest of the Jewish community should the Orthodox community be? In a Jewish Action review of the collected writings of Rabbi Soloveitchik, Rav Moshe Meiselman, Rav Soloveitchik's nephew, reflected on the aftermath of the Synagogue Council controversy. This is what he writes. The few letters in the volume regarding the issue of the Synagogue Council are but a tip of the iceberg of one of the major issues in Orthodox Jewish life of the 1950s. Unfortunately, the time has not yet come when the background and details of this controversy can all come to the fore. Just between me and you, you'll have to read Golden's PhD on the Synagogue Council of America if you want to get a glimpse at what he is alluding to. And of course, we link to that PhD in our weekly email, Reading Jewish History in the Parsha.substack.com. Continues Rabbi Meiselman, in 1956, a letter was signed by 11 of the leading Rosh Yeshiva of the United States, forbidding participation in rabbinic or synagogue groups, together with members of the conservative and reform movements. This would have meant that members of the Rabbinical Council of America could no longer be members of the Board of Rabbis, a mixed group, and that the Orthodox Union would no longer be able to continue its long-standing affiliation with the Synagogue Council of America. The letters of the Rav in this volume reflect that the publication of the Isser, the prohibition, of the 11 Rosh Yeshiva came as a surprise to the Rav, referring to Rabbi Soloveitchik. In the time immediately preceding the publication of the Isser, there was an intense dialogue between the Rav, Rabbi Soloveitchik, and Rav Aaron Cutler on reaching a compromise text to which the Rav could be a signatory. Both of these gedolim were interested in avoiding the divisions within the Orthodox community that would result from the lack of compromise. There were two other individuals whose political interests were served by a lack of compromise. These individuals, and he doesn't say who they are, but I know who they are, and if you read Golden's PhD really carefully, you'll find out who they are. These individuals published the text, the earlier text, thereby aborting the dialogue about a compromised text. The Rav never forgave these two individuals for creating the unfortunate tensions and acrimony that resulted from the lack of a compromised text. One can debate, says Rav Meiselman, whether the Orthodox community gained anything from the participation of the RCA in the Synagogue Council. However, the isolation of the Rav from the rest of the yeshiva world as a result of this controversy was certainly a tragedy that greatly limited his participation in and impact on the general yeshiva world. And this brings us back to our parsha. Banim atem l'Hashem Elokeichem lo sizgodlu v'sosasimu karcha b'neinechem l'meis. Your children of Hashem, don't gash yourself or shave the front of your heads. Be cause of the dead. The prohibition of separating from the community is couched within the verse, whose plain meaning is discussing the cutting of oneself in mourning. What do these prohibitions have to do with one another? Asks literally everyone, but you can look at the Maharal and the Gur Arya and the Parshiyasa quite explicitly. The answer lies in the beginning of the verse, you are all children of Hashem, banim atem, Hashem Elokeichem. How does this reason explain either prohibition, cutting during mourning or creating separatist community? At the heart of this statement that the Jewish people are described as the children of God is our distinct embodiment of transcendence and eternity, Netzach Yisrael, Lo Yishaker. The eternity of the Jewish people is undeniable. It is for this reason that we are cautioned against excessive mourning. Of course, it's okay to be sad, but excessive mourning evinces a detachment from the reality of the eternity of the Jewish soul and the Jewish people. A reminder that we are the children of Hashem is the very reason why our mourning should never become self-harm, since a part of each of us continues within the eternal family that is the Jewish people. And this is the very reason why we are cautioned from separating from the community. A family sticks together, and especially the eternal family that is the Jewish people should give a measure of confidence that differences, so long as they don't uproot the very foundations of Jewish life, can be overcome in order to remain connected to Knesset Yisrael, the eternal collective body that is the Jewish people. Before I wrap up, I just want to let you know two things. Number one, if you want to know who those two people who Rav Meiselman are referring to, again, you should read the PhD that we, of course, linked to in our weekly email, Reading Jewish History in the Parsha.substack.com. That PhD is from Jonathan J. Golden from Cooperation to Separation, The Rise and Fall of the Synagogue Council of America. And over there, you will find, if you look who the president of the RCA was, some family members, you'll get a lot more information of the politics behind the background. And a bonus for those who are signed up for our weekly email, Reading Jewish History in the Parsha.substack.com. We have a bonus edition in the email, Curb Your Parsha Enthusiasm, where we tell a fascinating intersection between our Parsha and one of the most famous Jewish incidents to ever happen on Larry David's famed HBO show, Curb Your Enthusiasm. Again, you need to sign up for our weekly email, Reading Jewish History in the Parsha.substack.com. There is a fascinating bonus over there that I included at the bottom for everyone who signs up. It's totally free. You could, of course, pay me to do it because it's a way you can donate for our work, but you don't have to in order to sign up. So please do enjoy it. And thank you so much for listening to Reading Jewish History in the Parsha. To get all the links to all the articles and books mentioned, if you didn't hear all my shoutouts already, subscribe to our weekly email, Reading Jewish History in the Parsha.substack.com. Thank you again to our sponsors, Jana and Lior Hode and family, with immense gratitude to Hashem. Thank you all so much for listening, and keep reading each and every Shabbos.